Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon. We want to welcome you to today's show of the American College Experience. My name is Jason Haynes. I am the host of this program and also the Chief Executive Officer of the UR Tennis Network, and we are so excited that you have tuned in today. If this is your first time in joining us, congratulations. We believe that you have found one of the greatest secrets in tennis. We have been broadcasting. This is our fourth year on air, bringing you interviews and shows about tennis that you probably most definitely will never see or hear on broadcast television. Probably not going to read a lot about these people in major news papers, magazines, but we are here to bring you their stories, and that's what we try to do each and every week. We currently have three shows that we broadcast each and every week. We've had as many as six on a week. And we are always looking for people that are interested in being a part of our team. We believe in the team approach to this broadcasting network. We are a group of individuals that has laid aside its individual dreams and decided that the team approach to tennis is the best way to go. If you have an interest in talking tennis, if you have a passion about tennis and think that you can talk for an hour, interview great tennis players, coaches, instructors, if you have a viewpoint that you think needs to get out there on a weekly basis, we would ask that you would contact me through the email, and that is jhaynes, H-A-Y-N-E-S, the number 10, the letter S, at gmail.com. And we'll start a conversation. We are currently working on a couple of shows that we will be hopefully adding very soon. This is not a rush job here. We like to get these shows taken care of, and our hosts, we want to make sure that they feel comfortable before they get on air. And so I want to remind you that on Monday we have Parenting Aces with Lisa Goodman-Stone. Lisa covers junior tennis in America. She has been following her son's rise through this junior USTA development, and she covers it well with the help of many of her friends. And then on Wednesday, before I come on the air, we have the great American coach, Chuck Creasy, and Chuck covers all things dealing with American tennis, and he has a lot to cover, and he handles the issues very, very well. Both of those participants are actually out at the U.S. Open this week, and we look forward to the many, many interviews that they can gather and bring to the UR Tennis Network from the U.S. Open this week and next week. On today's broadcast, we have Mr. Bob Wood. Bob is a Kalamazoo liaison for me and for the American College Experience. Bob and I actually met here in Tyler, Texas. I had no idea who this gentleman was. Got to visit with him, and now we see each other several times during the course of a spring semester. I've only been in Tyler a short time, but we've seen each other a few times, and this man has a wealth of Kalamazoo knowledge, and we're going to pick his brain today and bring you a little different perspective on this Kalamazoo story. But before we do that, I want to pass along just a few college tennis stories that are out there. And first and foremost, within the last week, it depends upon when you pick up this podcast or if you're listening live now, college tennis has lost one of its great ambassadors, one of its great historians, one of its great college coaches, and that, if you haven't been paying any attention to college tennis, was a great coach, Dan McGill, out at the University of Georgia. Dan was a great college tennis coach, has a great, one of those stories that we did not get to tell here on the American College Experience, and, you know, I thoroughly apologize for that. That's just one of those that we missed, and we're going to miss others, and we're trying as hard as we can to get these tennis stories that are out there that people need to know about into our library, and that way people can hear their story and hear what they've got to offer. But Coach McGill had a 60-year association with the University of Georgia. He worked three different jobs. He had three main capacities there at the athletic department in Georgia. He was a sports information director. And this is where it really helped him to become the tennis coach. He was famous there at the University of Georgia for also being a historian. As a sports information director, he, in his spare time, managed to become the wingiest college coach in college tennis. He also created the Georgia Bulldog Clubs there at the University of Georgia. He took over the tennis team, and he thought he was just going to do it 1 year, in 1955. And he was appointed by the athletic director, Wally Butts, and he was going to be the one-man search committee to find a successor for Professor Albert Jones. And he appointed himself only for a year or so, and then he coached it for 34 years, the men's tennis team, leading the Bulldogs to 21 SEC outdoor and indoor titles and national championships in 1985 and 87. And again, he retired in 1988 as the winningest coach in NCAA Division I tennis history with a staggering 706 and 183 win record. He made Athens, Georgia, the mecca of college tennis. When the NCAA tournament went to a team format in 1977, McGill and the community there in Georgia volunteered to host this tournament, and he assured everyone that he would this event would not lose money, and he enlisted the Athens community to underwrite the project. Georgia went on to host the tournament 21 times, including the first 13 in a row. And since then, the Bulldogs have won five of their national titles on those home courts. Well, people really don't understand what he did for college team tennis, and it's a trickle-down effect. You know, this affected many of the divisions since 1977, and I know that one of our former hosts on the show, J.P. Weber, his Yellow Ball Network, recently did a great show about the Coach Dan McGill, and I would encourage you to listen to that program. And we here at the UR Tennis Network will also follow up in the future with our own Dan McGill show. And we want to let those Georgia people have their moments. And it's a sad day when he passed away. There will be many more sad days as we go through this time highlighting these great American college tennis coaches. As many of you know, the U.S. Open, and you should know if you're an American tennis fan, the U.S. Open is going and going and going. We had many great things happen over the first couple of days here yesterday, which would have been Tuesday for me. The 15-year-old CeCe Bellis, she came out of nowhere, and she's surprised the American population. We look forward to her. And we're going to talk today about Noah Rubin. And as many of you know, what I've said here on the college tennis program is we are looking, we are searching for the great next American pupil tennis player to step up and make a charge here. And perhaps after today, we'll get some encouraging words that as far as the men go, we've got some exciting players about to step up. Well, now, before I get to Mr. Wood, I want to also let you know that the ITA recently announced its 2014 All-Star team. This is a great collection, and I really wish the ITA would do something with this team, let it compete, let it get together. This is truly a unique group of individuals. This is a collection of the best collegiate tennis players from the 2013-2014 season. This features the nation's top student athletes from all divisions, another great interdivisional representation of what the ITA is supposed to be about. Started in 1984. Unfortunately, this year, the All-Star team did not get to travel to the U.S. Open, the first time since its inception in 1984 that they did not get to go. And this is hopefully not a sign of the times for the ITA, for the U.S. Open, for the USTA, for the NCAA, for the NJCA, for the NAIA. We hope that everyone will recognize that this is an important piece of the puzzle, that everyone stay connected and interwoven here. Also at this event, they also recognize the ITA Arthur Ashe Jr. National Leadership and Sportsmanship Award winners, and I want to let you know that the those award winners are listed on the ITATennis.com website if you're interested. They're Division I, II, III, NAIA, and Junior College, and we won't go into their names, but I will go into the names of the All-Stars right quick, and then we'll hit for Mr. Wood. The All-Star team members, NCAA Division I singles, and we're going to start with the women here. Jamie Loeb, University of North Carolina. Robert Anderson, UCLA. Danielle Collins, University of Virginia. NCAA Division I doubles, Aaron Rutliff and Maya Jensen, University of Alabama. Lauren Herring, Kawasi, University of Georgia. Kendall Woodard, Megan Curry, Georgia Tech. Division II, Valentine and man, oh man, I'm going to butcher this name, Confanelli, Lynn University. Division III, Gabrielle Clark, Emory University. NAI, Jay Curtis, and NJCAA, Natalie Bavolina from ASA College. Jade was from Auburn University in Montgomery. And on the men's side, NCAA Division I singles, Marcus Duran, UCLA, Clay Thompson, UCLA, Guillermo Alcorta, University of Oklahoma, Division I doubles, Michaelis Libidus, Hunter Reese, University of Tennessee, Ashok Nuriana, and Max Schnur, Columbia University, Peter Kobelk, Kevin Metka, Ohio State University. Division II, Bruno Savi, University of West Florida. Division III, Joey Fritz, Amherst University. NAI, Denny Mack, Emory Riddle. And NJCAA, Josh Page, Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College. So congratulations to those All-Star winners. And we are excited that those teams, that those college tennis participants have been recognized by the ITA. We're excited that there is such a prestigious award given to those college tennis players, and you know, hope that the ITA will in the future pick up the tab on that. and they get those athletes back up there to New York. Now, before I got to let Mr. Wood know, I know he's listening out there. I've got a little bit of technical difficulties here, so hang on, Mr. Wood, then I'll get you on here in just a second. This is the joy of broadcasting. This is the joy of online broadcasting. Hang on, Mr. Wood. We'll get this taken care of. I myself having a little bit of internet trouble here out in the Tyler area, so we'll get this on. So the U.S. Open's been going on, and college tennis is represented there. John Isner is the guy that a lot of us are watching. We're hoping that this guy can have at least get into the quarterfinals out there. We are hoping that there is a breakthrough, perhaps, for a younger American. And we're waiting. We're waiting patiently that something happens. And this is a great time of the year for American tennis highlighted there at the U.S. Open. So I think I've got my technical difficulties worked out. I'm going to bring in Mr. Bob Wood here. Well, Mr. Wood, are you there?
I'm here, Jason.
Wow, very good, Mr. Wood. Apologies for those technical difficulties. You never know what's going to happen when you do these things. So, welcome.
Can you hear me?
I'm excited.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, I can hear you. Unfortunately, you know, and I say this each week with my my guest, Mr. Wood, there are going to be some people that listen in today that probably have no idea who Bob Wood is and his association to tennis. So if you will, give us a biography here quickly, Mr. Wood, and then we'll open the show and we'll start questioning away here and find out more about yourself.
Well, I grew up in the state of Michigan in a place called Grosse Pointe, Michigan, which is on the east side of Detroit. And I went to college in New York. Played lots of sports in high school, but tennis was my number one sport. Played tennis in college and then started coaching high school tennis in the early 60s in Pennsylvania. Moved back to Michigan where I spent 38 years at the same school. And then we moved to Jackson, Tennessee in 2002. And I coached at a school in Jackson, and 5 years ago we moved to Tyler, Texas. Excuse me. We moved to Tyler, Texas. So I have gone to the Nationals in Kalamazoo. By the way, Kalamazoo, Michigan is where the National 16 and 18 Boys Junior Championships are held every year for the past 72 years in a row. And Kalamazoo is located halfway between Detroit and Chicago on I-94 for those people that have never heard of Kalamazoo. Hello?
Bob, go ahead. I'm sorry. Keep going.
Oh, no. I've been there for 36 years. I'm one of the 1,000 volunteers that helps run the national championships every year, and it's literally my favorite 10 days of the whole year, and I look forward to year number 37 next year.
Well, very good, Bob, and that's the reason that you and I, or the reason I pursued you was your association with Kalamazoo, and we're going to get to that as we go through today's interview, and right away, you know, I'm curious about your college tennis experience. Yourself, where did you play college tennis at?
Well, I played at a very small Division III school. As I grew up and went through the juniors, I played the national circuit. Never did real, real well on the national circuit. I was ranked in the top 20 in the Midwest and my partner and I were ranked number two in doubles, and that was back in the late 50s. So that was many moons ago, and we certainly enjoyed all the years of traveling around and playing the national circuit. But as I said, I didn't do very well on that level, but I did fairly well in the Midwest, and then we played some adult tournaments and stuff like that as we started our careers. We both spent most of our lives in Grosse Pointe, Michigan.
And what was the name of the school, Bob?
The name of the school where I coached or where I went to school?
Yeah, where you went to school, where you played at?
Oh, I played at St. Lawrence University, which was in
okay.
Upper New York State. It's a small Division III school. And I had a great time up there, really enjoyed it, and would highly recommend to any boys or girls that are going off to school that can play a sport that they give it a go, because it's something they'll never forget. And I'm still in touch with a couple of my teammates from back in the 50s.
Well, now, Bob, in the 1950s, you've got me curious here. The format that you guys played collegiately, was this before the current team format that you normally play? How did that work for you while you were there?
We played six singles and three doubles.
Okay.
And you can play both, and that's very popular nowadays, I believe. I haven't kept up that much with college tennis. I mean, I have a few good friends that are coaches around the nation, but quite a few of the schools still play six and three.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Exactly. Play for 1 point each round.
Yes, sir. Yep.
Yep. And play two out of three sets for each event, singles and
yep.
doubles.
Yep.
You play tiebreakers,
before
the Van Allen?
We didn't have tiebreakers back in those days. I mean, we played some NCAA Division III tournaments on the weekends, and I mean, we'd go through a pair of shoes. Your big toe would be sticking out by the time Saturday afternoon showed up. It was long, long matches, grueling tournaments, and nowadays, of course, I think. Either this year or next year, aren't they going to all NOAAD in college?
Yes, sir. They're making a move to the NOAAD scoring system. Division I is going to make that move. The small colleges have not made it official yet. What we're afraid of in this environment here is that what Big Brother does, they'll force Little Brother to do.
Right.
And we'll wait and see what happens here.
One of the main reasons for that, I think, Jason, is that they're trying to speed it up and maybe make it where some of the matches could be televised or whatever. But, what they're doing, a lot of times they're going to a super tiebreaker now for third sets, and that's crept down into high school tennis now where a lot of our tournaments and stuff like that are, you're two out of three sets, but if it splits, you play a super tiebreaker.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, Bob, when you finished college, did you have and back in these days, no real professional tournaments per se. This was before the open era. So, did you participate as an amateur at any of the bigger events after you finished college?
No, sir. No, I wasn't. I wasn't good enough. I mean, I could hit the ball fairly well, but. I couldn't play at that level. I did play at Kalamazoo, however, back in 1958 and 59. I didn't do very well, but at least, as they say, I got into the tournament. I didn't last very long.
Sure. And you mentioned that when you went to St. Lawrence, were you was your major a major that was going to usher you into coaching, or was this a decision that you made after graduation?
No, that was a decision I made after graduation. And I, as You know, I started my high school coaching in 1961, but I just finished my 52nd year last year at All Saints Episcopal School, and we'll start my 53rd year coming up here pretty soon. But I majored in history and English, and in fact, I started my teaching career in 61, and I was teaching history and English, and I was coaching three sports. I was coaching JV football, varsity basketball, and varsity tennis. And then when I moved from Pennsylvania to Michigan, I continued to coach three seasons for quite a while. So I started to get a little bit older and stuff like that, and then I started to cut back a little bit. But tennis was the one big sport that I had the most success with as a coach, and also was blessed and have been blessed for over 50 years with just absolutely fantastic talent. And, you know, it's amazing what you can do when Michael Jordan plays basketball for you rather than against you.
That's a great way to put it, Mr. Woods.
Well, I mean, I had lots of nationally ranked players, and I had one boy by the name of Aaron Krikstein, who some of the people may have heard of, who back in the early 80s, mid 80s, was ranked number one in the nation in every age group and whatever, and went on and had a pretty successful career. He never won a major, but he got to lots of quarterfinals, semifinals of the, you know, U.S. Open, Australian Open, Wimbledon, and the French Open, but he never could quite get over that hump. But he, you know, when you're talking about having talent like that, it's pretty nice as a coach.
Well, I'm going to guess that as a high school player, Bob, that he was able to get over the hump several times for you and your team.
As a high school player, I'm sorry?
No, for Aaron Krikstein, as a high school player, I'm going to bet that he was able to get over that hump several times.
Yes, sir. He never lost. And we scheduled the best players we could find in Michigan and the Midwest to play him. But he only played 2 years of high school tennis and then turned pro, but he was ranked number one in the nation in every age group. And, you know, Jason, it just drives me crazy when some of these boys and girls all around the country, not necessarily just here in Tyler, but, you know, because they don't play high school tennis because it's quote, like a waste of their time. They are making such a huge mistake because they can work it out with the coach, they can work it out with the team, you know, so that they do play and help represent, you know, that school and whatever and become a member of a team. Because these kids nowadays, they grow up in this I-me world. And yeah, as you and I know, it's not an I-me world. It's a we world. And that's what they learn about being on a team. And Aaron will tell you, Aaron's 50 years old now, but he would tell you that the 2 years before he turned pro, 2 years that he played high school tennis, that were two of the best years of his life. He would say that right now if he was on the phone here. He really, really enjoyed it. Again, we tried to find the competition for him and whatever, but all of these kids should play high school tennis, should represent their high school. At least that's my feeling. Of course, I'm old school too, so.
Sure, Bob.
Anyway.
I'm curious now, when you first ran into Aaron Krikstein, did you, as you watched him in his first few practices, or maybe you knew him before he came out to the courts, did you know, well, this guy's good, this guy's got the goods to you know, take it to another level?
Yeah, I mean, he has something that a lot of the pros and a lot of the good juniors just couldn't deal with, and that was he had a world-class forehand, Jason. I mean, he, through the pros that he had and everybody that worked with Aaron but they didn't realize how world-class that forehand was. And when he turned pro, after his sophomore year in high school, he went to Boston, won the U.S. Pro as a 16-year-old, and beat three top 10 players in the world that week. And, you know, that's what woke everybody up. They said, oh, my gosh, we had heard that his forehand was pretty good, but we didn't know how good. But, I mean, it was just amazing. Now, the other parts of his game were not ready for him to turn pro. His serve, his volley, his footwork were not at the pro level when he turned. But he still, you know, that forehand, you know, for about 10 years was arguably the best forehand in the world. Yvon Lendl and Aaron, you know, were the ones that they talked about at that time. But anyway, he had a great, great career, and he was an outstanding young man.
Bob, as you coached your, have coached your 50 plus years in high school tennis. Before we get into the zoo here, you know, I wanted to ask. I mean, you've seen changes in rackets, you've seen changes in string, you've seen changes in athletes. So help me understand what major changes you've seen that have contributed to the rise of the current tennis player as we know it.
Well, I mean, I think it's just it changes as we go through history. I mean, the equipment gets better, the manufacturers make better stuff, so to speak. But I mean, the rackets are better, the strings are better, everything, and then of course the training of the athletes and the athletes, you know, every 5-10 years, whatever. What do you hear in every single sport? Is that they're bigger, stronger, faster. And 10 years from now, they're bigger, stronger, faster. And the coaching becomes better, the training, the physical training and all this becomes better. And so therefore your players of the, you know, 1990s are going to be better than your players in the 1950s or 60s or whatever. You know, as we come along now, we've had sort of a dry spell for a while, as you know, because we've had this John Isner, I think it is, has been ranked, he's the only American male ranked in the top 20 in the world. And he's been that way for a while. And we've had all these kids that have come through Kalamazoo and won Kalamazoo, but just haven't been able to do it since the early 90s or late 80s when we had the Michael Chang, Pete Sampras, Andre Agassi, you know, that sort of group that came along. But now you better watch out, because this year at the zoo, and we wanted to talk a little bit today about the zoo, but this year at the zoo, the top eight boys seated in the 18 and under singles, top eight, all made it to the quarterfinals for the first time in the history of the tournament. That doesn't happen in very many tournaments where the top eight make it to the quarterfinals. And these are the same group of kids that went over to Europe in May and represented the United States at the French and Wimbledon and whatever. And at Wimbledon, for the first time in many, many years, we had six out of the final 16 in the 18 draw at Wimbledon, and we had the two finalists. So therefore, we had the winner, and that was Noah Rubin, won Wimbledon, and then Noah, 3 weeks ago, won Kalamazoo, singles and doubles. And so this group of Americans right now has everybody at the USTA and around the country saying, look out, in 3 or 4 years, it could be totally different. So this could be a group of kids that will be like the ones of the late 80s, early 90s.
It's very exciting news. You know, and Bob, when we talked yesterday, I and Jess said to you that that must have been one incredible seating committee that had done that to get all eight young gentlemen, top eight young gentlemen into the quarterfinals. That's a dream seed, so to speak. Were you on that seating committee?
No. I've been working there for 36 years, but I work with two or three of them that were on the seeding committee, and not only did they hit the top eight into the quarters in the 18th, but in the 18 doubles, Jason, the top four seeds made it to the semis. I don't know what juice they were drinking, but the seeding committee. They couldn't have seated it any better.
Yeah. Now, Bob, we've got a caller on the line here. Sometimes we have callers that call in and just listen to the show. I'm going to go to this caller and see if they have a question for you. I can't imagine them having a question for me, but we're going to see if they want to ask you a question, and if not, we'll come back and talk some more Zoo. Okay, so hang on just a second here.
All right.
Caller, are you there? Caller, do you have a question for Mr. Bob Wood or myself? As I suspected, Mr. Wood, that person's probably just listening in the show today. Well, Mr. Wood, I have to ask, in your years of experience there at the Zoo, you mentioned that there are thousands of volunteers. Have you volunteered for the same thing over and over, or have you made your way around this championship?
I can barely hear you, but I've done several things. One time they asked me to be a line judge, and they put me on the baseline, and I was so nervous that I said if I ever got out of here alive, I would never do that again. That was back in 1987, and I said, I'll find some other area to volunteer for. So I called lines one time in my 36 years. And I also was in a chair as an umpire one time. But again, I was so darn nervous that I was going to affect the outcome of that match some way that I said that if this match gets over and I'm still breathing, I won't do it again. And I didn't do that either. But I have been on the second floor of the tower. There's a tower at Kalamazoo that overlooks 11 courts, and then they use the 20 courts at Western Michigan. So we have 31 courts within 5 minutes of each other. And I work on the second floor of the tower, and I am now, like, in charge of all of the radio and TV interviews, and I deal with the press and whatever, and have a great seat, one of the best seats in the house, obviously, up there with all these great players playing down below me. But it's a if you like junior tennis and you can ever get to Kalamazoo, it would be worth the trip. It's you know, the best that America has to offer you for about 10 or 12 days, and they start at 8 in the morning and they go until 6 at night.
Now, if you are listening out there and you want to call in today, let me remind you that 714-583-6853, 714-583-6853 is the call-in number, and you can call in and ask Mr. Bob Wood or myself a question. But Bob, that tournament's been going on, as you mentioned, 72 years. You've been there for half of that time at 36. I'm sure that complex, that area, has undergone some tremendous changes through the years. So can you help us understand what they've done, either facility-wise or tournament-wise, to improve that event?
Well, back in the 50s, Jason, the courts were red clay. Believe it or not, at Stowe Stadium and on the campus of Kalamazoo College, where the Nationals have been held now for 72 straight years. They were red clay back in the 50s. There were only nine courts. and they changed from red clay to hard courts in the, I'm going to guess, and I may be a little bit off, but I'm close. I'm going to say 62, 63, 64, somewhere in there. They went from the red clay to hard courts, and then about 4 or 5 years after that, they added two courts to go from 9 courts to 11 courts in the stadium. Now, they have 3 courts that are built inside a stadium that has bleachers and canopies and stuff on top of it, so people are looking down into the stadium where the 3 courts are, and then there are 8 courts around those 3, and a big tower that stands up in the middle of that that overlooks all 11 courts. Now, as I said, the host both the 16 and 18, they have to use other courts, and they use Western Michigan University's courts that are about 5 minutes away. They have 20 hard courts, so that gives us a total of 31 courts within 5 minutes of each other. And they play over 900 matches because they have the 16 singles doubles, 18 singles doubles, and then a back draw through the quarters for both the 16s and the 18s. So and every single one of those matches, all 900 and some, are chaired. So it's quite a setup, and it runs for, well, they had a qualifying tournament this year, so the tournament actually ran for 9 days, but then they had 2 days of qualies, and so the thing actually runs for 11 days.
Yeah, so in a sense, Bob, it has sort of a Grand Slam feel to it. I mean, a pro Grand Slam feel to it.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And if you talk to these kids that go to Europe and travel all around the country playing in tournaments and whatever, they will tell you that it is without a doubt, nothing even comes close, the best junior tournament in the world. I mean, it's much better than the Australian Junior, Wimbledon Junior, French Junior, whatever they say, because of and the key to this is the 1,000 volunteers. I mean, they actually, the tournament ended on a Sunday 3 weeks ago, and Monday morning at 8 o'clock is the first meeting for next year.
Oh, wow.
I mean, committees and so many, you know, as I said, the 1,000 volunteers of men and women that take vacation time that to work the tournament. And, I mean, they have everything from you get picked up at the airport and taken to the airport for free. You have shuttles that run from the stadium downtown every 15 minutes. I mean, everything. They have about 2,000 people that show up every day at lunch to watch the matches, and they have boxed lunches and outings and stuff like that to come. And we always make sure that there are 2 or 3 seeds that are scheduled to play at the lunch hour on the stadium courts. But where else in the world do you get 2,000 people watching junior tennis? Nowhere.
Exactly. Bob, I got to ask now, in your years, since you deal with the 16, I was going to ask that, can you hear me now?
Not very. All right, go ahead.
Okay. I was going to ask, in your time there, who do you remember the age of the youngest participant in the 16s draw?
In the 16s draw, I think Pete Sampras actually played in the 16s when he was 13. But I'm not sure if that's a record. I do not have that information here, but I know that he was like 2 years younger than the age, and he played in the 18s when he was like 16 or 15 or something like that. But I don't know who the youngest would be.
Yeah, it's a pretty memorable name, there, Bob. Now, Bob,
oh, yeah.
This year's group with this year's group of eight, we know that Noah Rubin had a phenomenal summer. Of those eight, were there other kids that impressed you maybe a little more than Noah, or were there on the equal level?
Well, yeah, they're really on the equal level. That's why I can give you those eight kids. The number one seed actually was a boy by the name of Jared Donaldson from Rhode Island. The number two seed was Ernesto Escobedo. He's from California. Reuben was seeded third, believe it or not. Won Wimbledon, but was seeded third from Rockville. He's from Rockville Center, New York. Number four was Stephen Kozloff from Pembroke Pines, Florida. Number five was a boy who won it last year. He won the 18s last year, came back to defend this year, by the name of Colin Altamirano from California, and he made it to the finals. He played Reuben in the finals. Reuben beat him in three sets. They actually played three out of five. It's the only junior tournament anywhere where they play three out of five in the finals. But Altamirano made it back-to-back in the 18s to the finals. Won it a year ago, lost in the finals this year. Number six was Francis Tiafoe. He's from Maryland. Number seven is Michael Moe, also from Maryland. And number eight is a young man by the name of Taylor Fritz from Rancho Santa Fe, California. They were the top eight seeds that all made it to the quarters.
And Bob, I noticed there weren't any Texans in that list.
No, well, the highest there were, a couple of years ago, we had some 16s. I can't remember their names right now, but the 16s that were seeded fairly high from Texas. The highest Texan, let me see, I've got my list here. He was seeded 18th, a boy by the name of Jacob Hansen from Austin, Texas. He was the only one seeded in the 18s. Let me see if we have any Texans from in the 16s. Yeah, we have one here, a boy by the, from New Braunfels. How do you,
New
Braunfels, say that?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
New Braunfels, yeah.
Yes. Liam Caryuna?
Yeah.
Liam Caryuna from New Braunfels or something like that. And then he was seeded number 11 in the 16th. And then we have a Texan from Heath, Texas, by the name of Chase Wood. no relation to me. But he was seeded number 20 in the 16th.
And now, Bob, from the quarterfinals on, was there a match that was talked about, or was there a match that you didn't want to miss, or one that stood out?
Well, you know, they were really sort of straightforward, and the number one seed was winning, but they had to retire because of a stomach problem in the quarterfinals. And that's how he went out. Everyone said he would have won it had he not been injured. But all of the other matches, believe it or not, Jason, were 6-2, 6-2, 6-3, 6-3, 7-5, 7-5. I mean, they were, you know, competitive matches. But in the 18s, in the 16s, we had in the quarterfinals the number one seed had to go to a tiebreaker in the third set, so that was pretty that was pretty exciting. But most of them, especially with the 18s this year, and maybe that's why the seeding committee did such a great job, is that they just hit the nail on the head, and most of the matches were not that close.
The Bob, nearest I can figure, you were at the zoo when you first started, around McEnroe's time, John McEnroe's time. Is that right?
No, I can tell you here.
What year did you start there?
I started in 1979, and I've been there every year. So in 79, in the 18th, where am I here? Okay, here we go. I got it. Scott Davis, a boy by the name of Scott Davis, and Ben Testament were the 2-1 and 2 seeds. Scott Davis won it, and then we went through a bunch of names that the people probably wouldn't know until you get up to 1987. Michael Chang won it, and of course we've heard from him in the pros. But then. And we had our first double winner in 93-94, a young man who was probably my all-time favorite for my 36 years, a boy by the name of Paul Goldstein.
Sure, won it in
93 and 94. He is now the new coach at Stanford.
Yes, sir.
Out in California. And then they had a bunch of kids that just didn't do real well in the pros, and it's been a little bit of a gap since. In fact, most of the great players, not all but most, never won Kalamazoo. Like Sampras never won it. Agassiz never won it. Agassiz won in the mid '80s. Agassiz won the 16 doubles, but he never got past like the quarterfinals or semifinals in singles. And Sampras never won it. So, I mean, isn't that amazing? These guys went on to have unbelievable pro careers but never won Kalamazoo.
It's truly amazing. So in your time, your period there, and you've kind of gotten a preview of what's coming for American tennis before anybody else. Should we, as American tennis fans, should we be excited about what's coming? Can we get that feel again?
Yeah, well, if you talk to the people at the USTA, you know, they're jumping up and down. I mean, we finally feel that we have a group of young men here that, you know, if everything goes right, and believe it or not, we went through a stretch where quite a few of these kids who won here or the top seeds, you know, would turn pro, which I am so against, Jason. I mean, I could take the next hour and talk about why they shouldn't turn pro. I don't think any of them should turn pro. None of them are ready to turn pro. And that includes all the champions. What they need to do is go to college, be a kid for a few years, try to win the NCAA, because peer pressure is the greatest pressure of all. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And so go out and play against your peers, win the NCAA, and then think about turning pro. But these kids at age 17, 18, none of them are ready. I mean, that's just my opinion. Again, I'm old school, and, you know, 90% of the tennis world nowadays think I'm crazy, and maybe I am. But, I mean, that's just my opinion. But let them be a kid. Go to a good school. They're going to be on a good team. They're going to have a lot of friends rather than go out and live out of the trunk of their car and try to play these challengers and qualifiers and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, be a kid for a few years. Enjoy it. Life got many years for them to try to make it on the pro circuit. Anyway, that's my $5 worth.
No, Bob, and I think you're on something here, and I think history is on your side, and I have a very good friend of mine, and you know him, Coach Dick Gould, who always told me that there was no reason to travel to all these expensive events if you're not, you know, number one on your block. If you're not number one in your city, what's the point in going to another city if you can't beat the best, you know? And I understand that more and more as I travel through this. I can't imagine spending thousands or tens of thousands of dollars if your child isn't the best, you know, to go somewhere else to know that he's still not the best.
Right. Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Yep.
And so I think that, you know, that has been part of the problem. And it goes back to what you were saying about high school tennis and a lot of these kids skipping these high school tennis events. And I turned this when I was a college coach. You know, we've got a group of point chasers here that will skip a tournament if Joe Bag of Donuts is playing because I can't beat Joe Bag of Donuts, but I'll go over here to Noonday, Texas, and I'll play in the Noonday Open because nobody's playing there, and I'll win that event and get some points.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah,
so
I totally agree with you. This high school tennis thing, you know, these kids, these really good players can get so much out of playing high school tennis. And as I said, all they have to do is sit down with the pros that they're working with, sit down with the coaches, sit down with the schedule, come up with a plan before the season even starts so you know when he or she is going to be there, you know when she isn't, and then I used to leave it to a vote of my team of whether they wanted Aaron to play. I said, here's Aaron's schedule. I mean, he was traveling all around the world and stuff like that, so he was going to miss some. But here's Aaron's schedule. He can be here for this, be here for that. He'll be here for the playoffs. He'll be here for the state tournament, all this sort of stuff. Okay, yes or no, do you want him on the team? And we had two votes because he played his freshman and sophomore year before he turned pro, and the vote was 12-0. I mean, every single kid voted to have him on the team, even though he was going to miss some. Because when he was there, he played number one, and that moved everybody else down and helped everybody else on the team.
Now, if I remember correctly, within the last week to 10 days, I think since the zoo, Jared, the number one seed, has decided to turn pro. We've got Noah, who's decided to go to Wake Forest for at least a year. Donaldson.
Did Donaldson turn pro?
Yeah, I believe that was the information I received recently.
That is just such a huge mistake, Jason. I mean, he's a great player. He's still 17 years old. He's still a baby. Live out of the trunk of his car and make these tournaments and be ranked 400th or 500th in the world, where he could go to any college in America, be on a great team, have some teammates right around him for support and stuff like that, go to some football games and be a kid and spend a year or two in college and then try it. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, Bob, and that's exactly why I wanted you on, you know, because you have an insight here and you've seen through years of experience, whether it be high school or at the zoo, you have a feel for what should be done and what needs to be done. And you know, I was going to ask earlier, and we're going to lose some of our live listeners here in a little bit, Bob, but, you know, we mentioned earlier, I asked you earlier about the changes you've seen in the athletes. Let me ask you about the parents, Bob. Have you seen changes? What are the major changes you've seen in parents over the years that you've been there at the zoo?
Well, one of the biggest problems, you know, in outside of Detroit, where I coached for almost 40 years and whatever, they've taken all these basketball games and eliminated the crowds and told the parents and everybody they couldn't be there. And if you could just take the kids and eliminate the parents in most cases, you'd probably be in great shape because it's very, very difficult. And some parents are great. It's not all, of course. But most of these parents are trying to live vicariously through their kids. Most of them think that they're, you know, the next Roger Federer or will be the next Roger Federer. And they just can't realistically see the trees from the forest, so to speak. But the parents have gotten worse. They've gotten much worse, and it's not just in tennis. I mean, it's in a lot of sports. And you know, I don't have the answer to that. I don't know what you can do. You can just I used to have a list of expectations for my parents that I used to give them, like the handouts that I give to some of the kids and stuff like that, and you know how they could be helpful to our program and whatever. And if they crossed the line, then we would have issues. Fortunately for me, I had very, very few times where I had an issue with a father, and that's saying something when I'm about to start my 53rd year.
Sure.
But I've been lucky, and I always kept the lines of communication open. I always made sure they knew what was going on. I always, you know, tried to work with them and whatever, and it just sort of seemed to work out. Plus the fact we were very, very successful for many, many years because, as I said earlier, I had lots and lots of talent. I mean, these kids were really good players.
Well, so, Bob, I knew about 20 minutes into this interview that we were not going to have enough time to get things covered today. And before I let you go today, I've got to ask, do you have an entertaining college coach tennis story that you might be able to share, something that happened to someone out there at the zoo that we might not hear about through the normal media channels?
Oh, wow. you caught me here. I don't know. Let's do it again sometime, and I'll have a story for you.
Very, very good. I would imagine, you know, Bob, before – yeah. I mean, before I let you go, I mean, this event collegiately, I mean, you must encounter tons of college coaches that come to this event, right?
Oh, yeah. There are about 70 coaches every year, and they're normally there for the first 4 or 5 days because once you get down into, like, the quarterfinals and stuff like that, most of those kids know what they're doing but or where they're going or whatever, but there'll be about 70 college coaches that will come to this tournament for the first 4 or 5 days.
Very good. Well, Mr. Bob Wood, I thoroughly appreciate you coming on today and spending some time with us here on the network, and I look forward to spending some more time with you as we go along through this. When I first met you, I had no idea who you were, and now I have a lot better idea who you are and need to include you more and more in our network and as a liaison here to this junior and college connection.
Well, I'd be more than glad to do it, Jason. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and, you know, since we are somewhat neighborly here in our area, I look forward to our battles this spring, Mr. Wood.
It'll be fun.
Yes, sir. Well, have a great day and enjoy. I understand that the weather's going to get cooler sooner.
That's good. Actually, this has been a great summer. We've only been here 5 years, and you know, 3 years ago when we had 53 straight days of over 100, that about did me in. But this summer, I don't have 100 yet, so.
Yeah.
I can't complain. It's been a great summer.
Yes, sir, Mr. Wood. Well, have a great day, and I look forward to visiting with you again soon.
All right. Thank you very much, Jason.
Yes, sir. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bob Wood. And what I like about Bob and what he represents here is he's got a great heart, a true volunteer for American tennis, 36 years at the top boys national championship here up in Kalamazoo, Michigan, the zoo. He's given a lot of time to American junior tennis. He's seen a lot of great American players come through there, pro and collegiate. He's dealt with a lot of great college coaches. And as you heard him here today, he's letting us know as American tennis fans that we should be excited about what is happening out here, and that we all need to take a deep breath and and relax a little bit and hope that that there is some good things coming down the pipe here. And as you heard him say, for the first time, they had the top eight seeds make it to the quarterfinals there at the Zoo. And you know, those were American boys with strong hearts and strong desires to represent this nation in the next 4 years out on a professional tour. Each one going to choose a different route. I, along with Mr. Wood and several others, hope that they will choose that college tennis experience, go through that, and as he said, experience peer pressure, win a national championship with their team, win a national championship as an individual, and then if they can do those things, then go out into that professional world and see what's out there. I think it's a stepping stone process, and I think that there are steps that need to be taken, and you don't need to skip those events. And so we'll get excited, watch the U.S. Open, watch the junior results from the U.S. Open, and see how these American players do, and then keep up with them as they travel into the future months and into next summer. So excited to have him on and look forward to catching up with him again in the future. Now, I want to let you know that next week we've got Coach Chris Garner. Garner was a hard one to catch. He is the Division III national champion from Amherst University on the men's side. Coach Garner actually was the coach there at Amherst. Over the summer he took the vacated position at the Naval Academy. And so we're going to bring him in, and we're going to talk some Amherst National Championship tennis. We're also going to talk some Navy tennis, and we're going to talk about how his summer's been and what's different, what's going on over there, and cover two schools in one show. And I want to invite you in for that. Please get out there and listen to other UR Tennis Network shows. They're out there. Go to iTunes. Go to www.blogtalkradio.com. Look up the UR Tennis Networks. That's the D and then the letters UR, the number 10, the letter S, network. And check us out. And have a great day. Go out and hit some tennis balls, and catch us next week here on the American College Experience. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.